This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, with a Monday deadline looming, the new Greek government agrees to at least formally negotiate bailout terms, despite its anti-austerity platform. The Federal Election Commission holds a rare public hearing in the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United and McCutcheon rulings. And an independent forensics team questions Mexico's investigation into the disappearance of 43 students. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Greece's newly elected left-wing government is facing a Monday deadline to find an agreement with its creditors or face default and possible exit from Europe's common currency. Talks between Greek leaders and European finance ministers progressed through the week in what's been the first real political challenge to the European Union's imposed austerity policies that brought deep cuts to public investment and skyrocketing unemployment across southern Europe. Jacob Resnick has more.
Austerity has become a bad word in much of Europe. For Greece, austerity policies that forced the slashing of public investment and privatization of public assets were the major strings that the IMF, European Commission, and European Central Bank attached to a $273 billion bailout. But 5 years later, in a bailout debt that's 175% of the nation's GDP, the left-wing Syriza party has swept to power on a platform of standing up to the country's creditors in the face of plummeting standards of living. Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis told Chinese broadcaster CCTV that the austerity measures have failed to achieve their aim, that is, to help Greece recover from the financial collapse.
If you have a cow that is sick and doesn't produce enough milk, and you start whipping it, and you whip it more and more and more to produce more milk, at some point it will die. So you won't get the milk you want. This is precisely what's been happening with the Greek economy over the last 5 years.
In the first breakthrough, Greece agreed Thursday to formally negotiate with its creditors. Critics say that's a major concession because up to now, Syriza has said austerity policies are non-negotiable. But Athens clearly needs time to maneuver. The bottom line, either Syriza accepts an extension of the current austerity-based agreement, the Eurozone agrees to renegotiate terms, or Greece goes broke. Eurogroup chairman Jeroen Dijsselbloem told reporters in Brussels that he was optimistic about technical talks, but said there were many hurdles ahead.
I am very cautious on the political side. It's going to be very difficult. It's going to take time, and don't get your hopes up yet.
Hugo Radice, a professor at the University of Leeds in England, is one economist who says Europe's austerity policies brought pain instead of recovery. But he says this is more about the political careers of European leaders than economics.
The leadership has boxed itself into a corner. They have so much of their political capital tied up in austerity. If they change direction now, then people are bound to say, well, how come this policy that you've pursued for the last 5 years, suddenly you're basically admitting that it hasn't been working?
Greece's economy is only 2% of the Eurozone total. That's why this country's defiance in the face of Europe's paymasters is seen as significant. If Athens wins a renegotiation in this round, it could start a chain reaction with other Eurozone countries. Spain, Italy, and Ireland top the list, questioning whether austerity is really a necessary hardship on the path to fiscal health or a long-term strategy to drive down wages across Europe in the name of global competitiveness. Talks are set to resume on Monday. If no agreement is reached, economists warn the nation will be dead broke by the end of the month. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
The Federal Election Commission held a rare public hearing this week. The all-day, standing-room-only event came after the FEC received 32,000 comments about potential changes to federal campaign finance laws following the Supreme Court's controversial McCutcheon decision. Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C.
Wednesday's hearing at the Federal Election Commission was supposed to be about campaign finance regulations after last year's Supreme Court ruling on McCutcheon versus FEC, which removed aggregate limits on individual donations to political parties of candidates for federal office. What ended up happening was the airing of grievances by advocates and government interest groups on a wide range of campaign finance issues, from Bitcoin donations to the Supreme Court's controversial Citizens United decision. Government affairs lobbyist for Public Citizens Congress Watch Division Craig Holman was one of over 30 witnesses and panelists to testify. He blamed the FEC itself for allowing dark money or undisclosed donations to plague federal elections.
This was not the creation of any court decision. It was not the creation of any act of Congress. It was a product of a rule that you passed in 2007 redefining what is disclosure as required under the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act.
That change created a loophole which allows political action committees to bypass disclosure rules, provided donations don't directly support a candidate. For example, spending on broadcast ads to further an issue or agenda does not have to be made public prior to the vote. Glenn Conway traveled all the way from North Carolina to testify on what happened during the Senate race between Democrat Kay Hagan and Republican Tom Tillis. The race cost $111 million, with about 75% coming from outside groups and PACs.
For 3 months, we were carpet bombed with negative ads by PAC after PAC. These PACs often provided erroneous and fraudulent information to voters, which was designed to confuse and mislead them. The messaging and ads were so relentless and so similar that it was impossible to separate one PAC or super PAC from another.
Campaign finance reform advocates say changes to disclosure rules, along with the Supreme Court's rulings on Citizens United and McCutcheon, have allowed a small group of wealthy people to take control of federal elections. Fordham Law professor Zephyr Teachout says wealthy people, companies, or groups effectively sponsor politicians and thereby limit public options.
So a political system populated by these sponsored politicians doesn't leave much choice for the public. They have the power to vote, but their practical power is only to choose between candidates who have been selected by these sponsors.
Other witnesses, namely conservative interest groups and GOP representatives, argued that more private money will actually help the political process. The Coolidge Reagan Foundation's founder Sean McCutcheon said any further rulemaking goes against the high court decision that people have a fundamental right to financially support however many candidates they choose.
I don't just say that because my name is on it. No matter whose name appears, the case was a stunning reaffirmation of individual liberty. It would certainly deserve the American people if we were to try to chip away at its foundation.
In both the Citizens United and McCutcheon cases, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the arguments that political campaign contributions are a form of constitutionally protected free speech. Data compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics found that spending by outside groups on federal elections skyrocketed from $338 million in 2008 to over $1 billion in 2012. And the 2016 presidential election is expected to be flooded with even more outside money. Just last week, billionaire brothers David and Charles Koch announced they plan to spend $900 million in the 2016 election. But how the FEC should regulate this spending in light of the Supreme Court rulings is unclear. Suggestions brought forth at the hearing included everything from revamping coordination rules for PACs and candidates to changing the number of FEC commissioners. The FEC currently consists of 6 members, 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans. Stanford University political scientist Bruce Kane questioned if the FEC even has the regulatory authority.
I believe it's the responsibility of the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the state legislatures to experiment with ways to deal with this constraint that the court has given us, but still to address these very real problems of fairness and polarization.
A package of reform bills was introduced in Congress on January 21st, the 5th anniversary of Citizens United. Among them was the reintroduction of the so-called Democracy for All Amendment, which would give Congress constitutional authority over campaign financing laws. The amendment failed last September to get enough support for a full vote in the Senate. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the weekly edition of Free Speech Radio News, celebrating 15 years of listener-funded grassroots news coverage. Find out more at fsrn.org. As many as 300 people are presumed dead this week, lost at sea while trying to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa bound for Europe. On Saturday, four overcrowded inflatable boats took off in rough seas from Libya. The Italian Coast Guard rescued about 100 passengers on one boat, but almost all aboard the other three vessels are missing and believed to have drowned. Joel Millman is press officer for the International Organization for Migration and joins us to discuss this tragedy and what's already looking like what could be the worst year on record for migrant deaths on the high seas. Joel, first, bring us up to date with the most current information on this week's mass drowning.
Conditions were very bad on the water. Some of the individuals did not want to board these boats and go into the sea, and apparently at least one witness said that they were beaten and hit with sticks and forced into these boats. We know that all of them so far are sub-Saharan African. We know that of the different nationalities that have been reported among the survivors, a total of, I think more than half are from the Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast, and certainly more than half of the confirmed dead are from Ivory Coast. And we up to now had not seen a lot of people from Ivory Coast taking this route to Europe, and they're saying they were part of a flotilla of four different devices, three of which are now lost, and we don't have an accurate number of how many people could have died in those other three.
Now let's place this incident into the broader context of mass drownings in the Mediterranean. We know that these types of incidents are unfortunately not uncommon. What patterns are emerging when you look at the data over several years?
Well, we know that the data tracks strife in some of the sender countries. I mean, last year, the Italian authorities brought 170,000 people to safety. 42,000 were from Syria, 39,000 were from Eritrea, two countries that are in terrible condition right now. So we know that it's the state of difficulty in some of these turmoil-ridden places, civil war in the case of Syria, and then just a terrible dictatorship in Eritrea. We know that that's driving. It's not a pull factor from Europe. It's a push factor from these countries. At the same time, another important factor is the lawlessness of some of the countries where the criminal groups that are operating can do so without much fear of being shut down by the authorities.
In this latest case, those aboard the vessel set out from Libya. How and why has Libya become a primary launch point?
Libya, we describe as a perfect storm for these criminal groups. We also know that Syrians of means, middle class and professionals, have been flying to places like Algiers, where they can then cross in through the desert into Libya through the back door and then access one of these boats at great expense. What's also emerging is the movement from Africa, from countries like Senegal and Gambia, in Mali that didn't figure quite as heavily in last year's statistics. We think these things have a momentum that's fed by social media, by trafficking groups, by people that just hear enough about it. And we can't ignore this sort of counter propaganda from personal friends and relatives of some of the victims who hear just the opposite, that it's not that bad, that they can get on a boat, they can get to Europe in a couple of days. So we know that this is probably going to grow, and the fact that it's happening now in January, February, where winter crossing tends to stop until things warm up again, is also remarkable. We had 3,500 people arriving in January. 2 years ago, there were 200 people arriving in January.
You mentioned Syrians as one of the groups of people who seem to seek out these perilous cross-sea journeys. Aren't there mechanisms in place to allow those fleeing the violence in Syria and the civil war there to seek asylum without having to risk their lives at sea?
There probably are. You know, Lebanon's made it much harder for Syrians to cross and relocate. I mean, it's a country of 4 million that's taken in almost 2 million Syrians, and we praise the Lebanese for their welcome attitude, but even they've reached their limits. Jordan has similar problems taking in Syrians and housing them in refugee camps. I mean, the neighbors, Turkey, obviously has done heroic work finding safety for these refugees. When you mention asylum seeking, migrants that we're seeing really crave the opportunity to be with relatives who maybe preceded him to some of the European countries or to North America. So for them, the refugee camp situation is not a solution. You know, we saw this end of the year in Syria where whole villages, whole neighborhoods were leaving parts of Syria and trying to get on these boats and spending $10,000 per family, you know, to get on the boat. This reflects a kind of liquidation of wealth and a mass transfer. I'm not sure refugee camps the answer for people like that.
Joel Millman is press officer for the International Organization for Migration. He joined us by phone from Geneva, Switzerland. In Mexico, a non-governmental team of forensic anthropologists brought in as independent experts to investigate the fate of 43 abducted students has publicly distanced themselves from the official story about the case. Shannon Young has the details.
The Argentine forensic anthropology team raised serious concerns over the weekend about the integrity of Mexico's investigation into the case of 43 disappeared students. In a 7-point list of issues, the forensics team cited problems with evidence collection, independent oversight, and crime scene preservation. They also noted that the government closed the investigation before the completion of key detective work. It's the first public statement from the forensics team since high-ranking officials announced they have no doubt the students were all killed the night of their abduction, burned to ashes and tiny bone fragments in an open-air trash dump, and their remains then thrown into a river. In a press conference Monday, parents of the missing students expressed their confidence in the team and also their concern for each member's safety, given their now public criticism of the government's handling of the case. Parent Melitón Ortega.
Nosotros respaldamos la confianza.
We reiterate our faith in and support of the Argentine team. Their work is technical and based on science, not on politics. They're reviewing all of the evidence that has emerged over the course of this investigation.
The Office of the Attorney General, known by its Spanish acronym PGR, issued a terse and defensive communique in response to the issues raised by the Argentine investigators. The PGR stated the independent experts' qualifications are limited to the fields of anthropology, criminalistics, and genetics, and their opinions on other aspects of the case are, quote, more speculations than certainties. The Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team is an internationally recognized group of experts formed to identify the remains of state-sponsored violence during Argentina's Dirty War. The group has since carried out sensitive and high-profile human rights investigations in places like the former Yugoslavia, South Africa, and East Timor.
Han traído expertos de diferentes países.
Ayotzinapa student David Flores says the Argentine forensic anthropologists consulted with international experts in other fields before going public with their concerns. But even when considering only the issues of forensic anthropology, the criticism is damning. For example, the Austrian lab analyzing the DNA of charred bone fragments was unable to use 20 genetic profile samples taken from relatives by government investigators. The Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team says these types of errors are rare due to the simplicity of the sample-taking procedure. Santiago Aguirre of the Miguel Agustín Pro Juárez Human Rights Center says the concerns raised by the Argentine forensics experts point to larger questions.
¿Qué habría pasado si no estuviera el equipo argentino con esa información?
What would have happened had the Argentine team not been there with this information? How is it possible that these kinds of elementary level mistakes are being made in what's one of the most closely watched cases in years? And what about in the cases of other disappeared people? In how many of the more than 23,000 other cases have these same mistakes been made?
The Attorney General's office has made no indication that it will reopen the investigation. The parents of the missing students say their biggest hope for a re-examination of the case lies with pressure from international bodies. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Mass mortality events, or large-scale die-offs, appear to be on the rise among various species of birds, fish, and marine invertebrates. A recent study by scientists from the University of San Diego, Yale University, and UC Berkeley looked at die-offs, sometimes involving millions of individuals of a species, and noted an increase of one per year over the past 70 years. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus spoke with co-author Samuel Fay, a postdoctoral fellow in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department at Yale University.
Samuel Fay, please start just by describing why you and your colleagues undertook this study about mass mortality events.
We talked about kind of how kind of surprising they are and how kind of morbidly fascinating some of these events can be. But then, you know, as the discussion moved on, we started to talk a little bit about how often these events are seemingly blips on our radar and that they attract a large amount of coverage, but then in general aren't put into any greater context in the media. And so we looked to see if there was any synthesis across different animal mass mortality events that began to look at some of the changes in occurrence, causes, and magnitudes of these events through time. And we were really surprised when we learned that there hadn't been any effort like this. So we thought this would be a good opportunity to try to shed some light on a process that attracts a lot of attention but is rarely put into any greater context.
Can you give me one example? I think there was one where it was a huge die-off of starfish?
Yeah, so this didn't make it into our database because we stopped reporting on events in 2012, I believe. But yeah, there's an ongoing sea star mortality event that has been occurring on the west coast of North America where millions of starfish have died. And it does beg the question of, you know, what are the ecological consequences of this type of event? I mean, certainly that amount of dead biomass could certainly be used as a resource by any organism that's able to take advantage of that. And it also has the potential to just disrupt entire food webs in terms of how those organisms interact with their predators and their prey.
Some of the reasons that were given for different events, one was starvation, one was disease. One was biotoxicity, and then there was a combination of multiple stressors that acted together. How much do you see connections with climate change resulting in any of these die-offs? Is that something you're looking at? Is that something you know is a factor?
So it's really difficult to take any of the causes that we show in our study and connect them directly to something like climate change. However, it is interesting to look at the trends and the causes underlying these events. For instance, one of the causes in our database is thermal stress. And over the course of this 70-year period of time, we did see a decrease in the number of events caused by cold thermal stress. And so it's interesting that this is in keeping with patterns that we've seen in recent climate change related to decreases in the severity of winter. So, you know, at this point, it just shows that there is perhaps an association, but by no means does it implicate climate change directly in patterns of these events.
Samuel Fay is a postdoctoral fellow in the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Department at Yale University. He spoke to us in the student lounge at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature is discussing two bills that would alter the state's public school system. For many, these changes open the door to for-profit education. Zoe Sullivan reports from Madison.
On a sunny afternoon, Anna Marie Moffitt waits for her children outside Thoreau Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. Public schools like this one are at the heart of a state legislative debate over education policy reform. One controversial bill would force so-called failing schools to convert to charters if efforts to improve failing grade test scores are unsuccessful over the course of 7 years. The Senate Education Bill aims to create two separate education boards independent of the state's Department of Public Instruction. One for private schools receiving public voucher dollars, and another for public and charter schools. Both boards would be run by political appointees and would be able to mandate how schools operate, ostensibly to improve test scores. Moffitt, mother of three school-aged children, including one with special needs, has decided to run in Madison's upcoming school board election.
A big problem that I see is it's taking local control away from locally elected officials and putting it in the hands of these outside entities that are not connected to the community in any way and are actually government appointees. which is very concerning.
Representative Jeremy Thiesfeld, a Republican from Fond du Lac, drafted the assembly bill. He did not respond to multiple interview requests, but he told Wisconsin Public Radio that the Constitution permits bypassing local school boards.
When things are not operating as they should be and repeated attempts are made to fix it, ultimately the state has that responsibility. Now, I don't want any public schools to be changed over to charter schools. I want them all to be successful. But as I said earlier, you reach a point where you have to start taking some serious measures because the changes that are needed aren't being made.
During a public hearing on the reforms last month, Thiesfeld acknowledged that the conversion measure does open the door to for-profit education, confirming the fears of many public education supporters. One group in favor of the education policy reform is the American Federation for Children, which now employs former State Assembly Speaker Scott Jensen as a lobbyist. Maureen, Mo, Mae Grimm, a former school board member from Mineral Point, ran for the State Assembly in 2012 and says she encountered the American Federation for Children then.
I've seen the influence firsthand of big money interests in privatizing our schools in our elections, and I'm concerned about that influence in our laws, and that's what brought me here today.
Even prior to the proposals currently before the legislature, Wisconsin's education budget had been on the chopping block. Legislators slashed $1.6 billion during the last budget cycle. Instead of reversing significant tax cuts at the root of the state's $2.2 billion shortfall, the education bills look to make even deeper cuts to education spending by targeting schools with low test scores. Many poorly performing schools are in Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, where 82% of the students in the district qualify as low income. Rachel Schleuder has been teaching in the Milwaukee public school system for 25 years. She says that instead of punishing teachers in public schools, the state should do a better job policing private schools receiving state funds.
We have so many children in MPS that need that community-based school. And, you know, we've seen so many voucher schools up and leave in the middle of the night. Just recently, before vacation, we had a high school that actually left around 200 students without a school that their parents had to look for an alternative right after vacation.
The Department of Public Instruction barred the school from participating in the state's voucher program on December 22nd. Representative Thiesfeld's bill was slated to fast-track through the assembly, but conservative opposition to a section of it derailed the up-or-down vote. Thus far, a new version of the bill has not been released for review. The state currently spends just over $4 billion a year on education, not including transportation or special needs expenses. It's not clear how much could end up in private pockets if the conversion plan moves forward. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, Madison.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. You'll find more information online at fsrn.org. Louis Reining at WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia, provides technical support. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Music used in today's program is by Scion via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.